Welcome to this podcast on digital transformation projects. I'm Matthias Koch. I'm a partner in the intellectual property and information technology practice of Freshfields. And the reason why I'm here in London together with my colleagues is that we've just had a strategy meeting outlining how Freshfields is going to address its own digital transformation over the next 3 to 5 years.
I'm Theresa Ehlen. I'm based in the Frankfurt office. I'm a senior associate in the technology, media and telecoms sector.
My name is Richard Byrne. I'm a partner in the Hong Kong office where I head up the Asia Technology and Intellectual Property Practice. I've been working on a number of very exciting projects opposite the likes of Alibaba and Tencent for various brand owners over the last few years.
Now, Richard, what exactly is a digital transformation project?
From the lawyer's perspective, there are really two aspects to these projects. The digital part is quite clear. We're talking in broad terms about digitizing products and services, adding new digital features or capabilities, or even digitizing internal functions. The transformation part is perhaps less obvious. For the most part, we're actually talking about traditional non-tech companies who are embarking on a strategy to digitize areas of their business on a significant scale. For that reason, whether these companies choose to develop the technology through the use of their own resources or to partner with a digital service provider, these projects take legal counsel, who don't come from a tech background, into some very unfamiliar areas.
Theresa, you've been living through some of those projects for a long time now. How are these projects different to your work previously?
I think one of the differences, and that fits nicely with what Richard just said, is that across all industries, companies face challenges which they previously haven't faced. There are lots of legal firsts. Traditional principles have to be applied to new technology, to digital assets. And this poses a challenge for the clients, for the companies, also for us as lawyers. You have to be creative and you have to find future-proof solutions as far as possible. You have to collaborate with technical advisors and with the technical staff of your client to actually understand the technology and what is the objective. It's changing so fast, so you don't have one set of solutions, but you have to adapt all the time.
It's often not clear what's achievable. Working with the technology teams, therefore, is absolutely crucial. Listening to their explanations of what the technology is, of where the obstacles lie, when it comes to documenting the pathway to reach those objectives, putting in place a legal framework, building a set of rights and obligations of the parties working together to achieve those technology outcomes. In one project I worked on, the objective of which was to integrate new augmented reality features into a retail environment. There were lots of curved and shiny surfaces in that particular retail environment. The service provider was extremely concerned about whether or not they could get their very sophisticated augmented reality tools to recognize these surfaces. When there is that uncertainty about what can be achieved, the provisions around the commitment of resources, the priority that will be given to the project, and the governance and escalation mechanisms that are designed to resolve issues as they arise can be more important than stating the end goals, because often they can't really be clearly defined. Sometimes you break those down into the aspects of the project which are essential for launch, and then there may be a further set of objectives which are more difficult to achieve, and there will be softer obligations that sit around that.
If we turn to some of the legal issues for a minute, and you could tell me about what the biggest challenges you think our clients facing in terms of the transformation projects. We obviously touched on some of them already, but one of the biggest challenges seems to me to be the liability piece.
Absolutely.
In a connected world.
The difficulty when dealing with digital transformation projects and liability is because of what you mentioned, Matthias, the connectedness. All the different players interact so closely with each other that you have to document who's responsible for which part and allocate the liability. You've got a software manufacturer could get liable for a fault in the software, which then leads to a machine not working properly and maybe a personal injury. So suddenly the software developer or the company behind that faces the challenge, could I become liable for the injury of that person?
I'm assuming that there is an industry standard about to emerge at some point, but that right now it is a concept in flux.
Absolutely. Right now it's how you structure it in the contracts, how you allocate the responsibility, and it's about negotiating it with the parties. because, as you said, the principles in law do not foresee the scenarios.
We see that in lots of other areas as well. Data, of course, is critical to all of these projects. It's the big driver of digitization in general. We often talk quite glibly about ownership of data. Clients ask us who owns the data in this, that, or the other situation. The point there is that data is not a legal right per se. It's not intellectual property for the most part. It's just information. And the legal protection for data that does exist is generally indirect. Now, the big exception here, and I need to always remind myself of this when I come to visit London, which is still part of Europe for the next year, is the European database right. But that is very much an exception in terms of the international treatment of the ownership of data. The other critical piece of the puzzle, recognizing the fact that there are very few underlying rights to rely upon, is to very actively police the terms of those contracts, the way in which your counterparty is making use of your data and your customers' data. There's often a big tussle between the parties in a partnering project as to who will get ownership of the data and what uses can be made of that data. Now, if one is partnering with a platform provider, for example, and the front-end functionality has to be integrated with the platform, and that's the point of the project, then the reality is that the data is going to be collected on the platform provider's platform and housed on their servers. And part of their service is the benefit of pooling data and creating a sort of ecosystem around it. So they can mount a pretty convincing argument that they need to keep control of the data. One particular project I worked on involved integrating a loyalty app with a messaging platform, which also involved adding e-commerce functionality. We found ourselves arguing over things like who would get the customer's open ID, the tracking code for a particular transaction, the trade order number or the card ID if a credit card was being used. That comes back to the point about the need to really understand the technology and what data is being generated. That requires a very close collaboration with the technical guys.
We all know that data protection these days is high on the agenda of regulators and hence of companies and consumer protection organizations. How does that feed into your advice on structuring projects, given the prominence and the risks involved?
Companies face the challenge of having to deal with data protection and the general data protection regulation. One item which we always see is the privacy by design, for example, saying when setting up the project, we want to have safeguards in place and we want to have a data privacy compliant project, and then having to reflect that in the contracts.
The other aspect of this is aligning data privacy policies. So if one is partnering with a digital service provider, if one is developing new digital features to sit on a platform, simply rely upon the platform terms and conditions and the data privacy policy that applies to that platform, it may be completely unsuitable for the nature of the project that the parties are developing. So that clearly is something that needs to be scrutinized. And if there is a need to upgrade the data privacy policy, that's an obligation that has to be flown down to the digital service provider.
When we're talking about data, the common denominator of all of these projects is that they are not national in scope.
Absolutely.
Because they are transcending borders, transcending economic areas. How does that play out in your projects in terms of the advice you're giving?
The global aspect is indeed one of the key characteristics of transformational projects. Do you start rolling it out everywhere at once, or do you start with core jurisdictions and maybe even one jurisdiction territory and then apply that principle to the other ones? If you start too late with the global aspect, the project and your contracts may be perfectly suitable for that one country, but you may then identify too late that in another country there are, for example, data localization requirements.
When we talk about data localization, we're talking about constraints on the ability to transfer data, personal data in some jurisdictions, non-personal data, or other categories of data in certain other jurisdictions. There are several examples of these types of approaches in my part of the world, China and Indonesia being standout examples, China under the cybersecurity law. The Shanghai municipal government just a few months ago introduced a requirement for all personal data generated by bike sharing schemes to be housed on servers in China and only used in China. Not really something that you would necessarily expect. Clients are grappling with a whole range of issues in terms of their ability to extract data related to their businesses and data related to their customers from China under the cybersecurity law. There's another very important point to make, which is that the general data protection regulation, GDPR, is not just an issue for European companies. It does have a degree of extraterritorial effect for companies based outside of Europe who are supplying products and services into Europe or collecting the data of European citizens for analytics or for profiling purposes. We're starting to see already a flow down effect of some of the new rights, some of the enhanced standards of data privacy protection under the GDPR into systems of law in other countries, including in Asia. So both Singapore and Hong Kong at the moment are undertaking a review of their existing data privacy law. And actually China surprised everyone by coming out with a new data privacy standard. It adopts, in fact, some of the GDPR rights, albeit in a slightly more limited manner. It adopts the right of erasure, or the right to be forgotten, as it's termed in the GDPR. It only applies to a slightly more limited set of data, but that right is now enshrined in Chinese law. It also introduces the right of data portability. Again, it applies to a more limited set of data, but it does apply to health data, educational data, and employee data. So we'll start to see situations where account needs to be taken of those rights in projects outside of Europe as well. This can have a very big impact on global projects. If the data cannot be freely shared, even within an organization, how do you manage that? Is it, for example, necessary to have ring-fenced systems or completely segregated systems for particular countries to manage these requirements? In other cases, these requirements can be managed by putting in place proper internal contracting mechanisms.
On the positive side, I'd like to think that much of what we do is enabling clients to pull these projects through, thinking through with them constructive solutions rather than just saying you can't do this or you can't do that.
These projects are often given very high priority because of the potential to transform the way the business is run and to unlock new areas of value and new revenue streams for the client. So there is a commercial imperative to find ways to execute these projects. There are, generally speaking, workarounds for most of these issues.
I couldn't agree more. It makes a major difference at what point the lawyers get involved. If you get involved at the very beginning, you have the opportunity to develop those workarounds, to enable the solutions. If everything is already set up, if the infrastructure is already there, and then legal gets involved, it gets harder to act as the enabler.
So you're effectively there with the client at the workbench, really trying to shape the product, as it were.
Absolutely. And as Richard said, that is one of the most interesting aspects. When we started setting up a global industrial Internet of Things platform, we had an initial kickoff meeting where we thought, okay, this is just as any other project. We get some facts and go back into our chamber and start drafting. But it didn't go that way. We started with a kickoff meeting, yes, but then we started working in a big team with the client, with lawyers from the client, with technical expertise, with business people. We sat together on screen where we had a contractual document and said, where do we want to go from here and how do we want to start? We have to address, for example, the supply side. We have to buy in IT infrastructure. So we have to negotiate these contracts. Then we want to go to market. What's the strategy for that? What's the timeline for that? How can we then draft the contracts? And do we start with the customer side? Do we start with the supply side? Because they have to fit together in the end.
Human resources issues play a very big role. And we're now joined by Caroline Stroud. Caroline is heading our International People and Reward Practice Group. And she's here to talk about the challenges that digital transformation projects pose to HR issues. Caroline.
One of the very important impacts is that innovative working practices, or sometimes it's called agile working, can mean that people have to work in different ways together. So rather than having a traditional collaboration in the office with a hierarchical structure, we've seen things like Scrum working develop. Scrum working is where you have autonomous, flexible teams without a leader and without hierarchy. They're given a task such as, we want you to develop an app and we're going to let you go off and do that yourself. Where that raises HR issues is one in consultation with any kind of worker representatives, because working conditions might have to change. People might have to report to different people. But more interestingly, it's a challenge as to how to incentivize people and reward them, because you don't judge the individual performance, you're actually judging the team performance and the team output. So it requires, from an HR perspective, a revolution in looking at how to incentivize and assess people's performance.
When you advise a traditionally industrial company, you've got engineers, you've got different staff. What you usually don't have is, for example, a software developer. So you have to start recruiting people with a very different skill set from what you previously had in your company. And bringing that together with your traditional workforce can create benefits, but it can also create frictions.
Yes, absolutely. I think that having a clarity of culture when you bring organizations together is absolutely essential. There's two types of consultation that should happen on a constant basis, which enable iterative cultural change, the collective and the individual. Then I think there are five basic steps to pushing a culture forward in an organization. And the first one is you must have clarity of tone, clarity of messaging from the top. Secondly, your policies and your guidance to your employees as to what's acceptable, what isn't, how we want to operate need to be developed and communicated. People need to be trained. You mix groups in your training, so you're learning about the differences between different groups of people, so you develop more understanding from, say, the software developers of the more industrial employee and vice versa. Then you must have accountability for making sure that there's progress in respect of that culture being embedded. How you measure that is very difficult, but there are ways to do it. You can do spot surveys, you can do interviews with employees, you can have a speak-up line and specifically ask people to raise anonymously what's going wrong, what's going right. You can do that on a constant basis. Achieving cultural change takes between 5 and 10 years. And so you will not be able to stop your efforts. It must be continual. Then you must constantly review. So every year you should do some form of cultural audit or survey. You know, where are we? Where have we got to? And are we achieving what we want to achieve?
From what I've seen, it's really important to get people on board, because the best project doesn't work if you don't have the buy-in from people.
Yes, the consultation stage is absolutely crucial to getting buy-in, because you have to bring people's hearts and minds. And that doesn't happen if you just provide an order or you give them a paper. You have to involve them in the decision-making process itself.
So to sum up, we were only able to scratch the surface of digital transformation projects, the global nature, the multidisciplinary nature, the multi-jurisdictional nature has become very clear. What's most exciting about this is we learn as we go along. So each time we work on these projects, we build up know-how, and we are very happy to share that know-how. Thank you all for listening, and please stay tuned.